Good morning, everyone. I'm Stacy Razgon. I cover the U.S. semiconductor sector here at Bernstein. And it's my great honor today to introduce our guest, the President and CEO of Analog Devices, Mr. Vincent Roche. Now, of all the companies I cover, ADI is probably one of the most respected. It's got an extremely high-quality franchise in the analog space, particularly as it relates to signal conversion and processing. Over the last decade or so, they've embarked on a rationalization program of both their product portfolio as well as their manufacturing footprint. They were smart enough to exit mobile early enough to actually get paid to do it versus some of the other things we've seen recently. And they've increasingly focused their product offerings on high-value applications, whatever the end market, as well as greatly increasing their presence in new markets like automotive, healthcare, and more recently, consumer. So there's a story developing there. And they took very early steps, I think, before many of their peers actually to shutter unnecessary capacity. The result's been a company with a steadily improving economics. Their trough margins today are now higher than their peak margins used to be before the downturn. I'd say in my conversations with clients, investment controversies right now tend to be focused on potential upside of new consumer and portable socket wins. Questions of how much margin expansion, if any, could remain in the model given they're running, you know, in the ballpark of their long-term model that they put forth. Whether their recent return to growth can be sustainable for the long term, and whether a renewed focus on cash return can actually continue to drive value over the long haul. So to answer these and hopefully many other questions, gives me great pleasure to introduce the President and CEO of Analog Devices, Mr. Vincent Roche. Vince, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Stacy.
There are question cards on your seats, by the way. You can feel free to fill those out. Those will be brought up, and we'll leave some time at the end for those questions.
Great. Thank you for the introduction.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. I've got a number of questions I want to attack on many things. I think the thing right now that is probably most top of mind for most investors actually is the new consumer ramp. And I've had clients put it to me like this. He had this kind of very stable, if not boring, high-quality story has now all of a sudden become potentially very exciting. I was wondering, now you've always also said, you know, that anywhere you play, you look to provide differentiation in order to produce good economics and stickiness, whether it's consumer, whether it's anything else. Can you talk to us a little bit about these new wins? What is it about these new types of products that actually is truly differentiated and defensible versus anybody else actually coming in? Does it utilize capabilities or IP that other competitors just can't deliver? I mean, that's one of the big concerns I think that investors have.
Yeah.
Given that this could provide upside, how sticky is it? How can they get confidence that it is sticky and sustainable?
Okay, great question. So maybe I can step back a little. You touched on during your introduction that we've been busily rationalizing ADI over the past 5 or 7 years on the product portfolio side, on the manufacturing side. And we've steered ADI very much towards what I would call more B2B applications. Mm-hmm. 5, 6 years ago, we were spending virtually 40% of all the R&D of the company in what I would call very volatile, more vertically oriented consumer-type applications mm-hmm. in PC, mobile, and so on and so forth. So we've greatly trimmed the spend in those areas and really targeted the R&D now heavily towards industrial automation, instrumentation, healthcare, automotive, and communications infrastructure. So to a large extent, ADI's core business can be considered B2B related. Mm-hmm. But we've always been very consistent as well that in the consumer area, where we can leverage the technology platforms that we build and sell into that diverse set of applications mm-hmm. in B2B, where we can leverage that technology to solve really difficult problems for the market-leading consumer customers, particularly in precision technology, mm-hmm. Where we can see not just a one-shot wonder, but we can see several generations worth of performance enhancement, mm-hmm. where we're playing at the edge of technology, what the technology is capable of doing, that we play. And, you know, I think what you're seeing is, you know, for several years we were sitting here talking about the headwinds that consumer
right.
was pushing on ADI.
Well, that's one problem because I think there was a socket loss involved in that, right? People want to make sure that that does not happen again.
It was more about the reconfiguring of our entire consumer business mm-hmm. from a 40% R&D spend across multiple areas to a more, I would say, more modest spend. We're spending less than 10% of the R&D now in consumer. Mm-hmm. You know, a chunk of it goes into what we call prosumer AV. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, been about half of our total consumer business for the last 2 or 3 years. But that has all the attributes of our B2B business, lots of sockets, lots of customers, longer life cycles. In the portable space, you know, you've got to play in there in a very, very careful way. You've got to be sure that you can get multiple sockets, or as sure can be. And that's how we're playing that game. So I think it's a modest R&D spend. We're in a very good position at the edge of technology, and we're going to keep pushing it. There's an appetite for ADI to keep extending the performance leadership there.
Got it. So that modest R&D spend, however, is sufficient enough, you think, to provide differentiation and stickiness for these new products?
It is, because we're leveraging technology platforms that are already available. And what we're doing is really customizing the platform to build a particular product for a particular sensor type, and a particular interface type.
Can you give us an example of the other models, or other end markets or applications where you've used this sort of similar platform technology that's going into these new markets?
Well, for example, in healthcare, we've been very busily tuning up our healthcare strategy as well around areas like building integrated photonics, precision signal processing modules for things like CAT scanners, MRI systems, digital X-ray. That, again, is a use of the precision technology platform. Another one would be in industrial automation, developing integrated platforms for things like robotics control. So those are examples of where the precision technology of the company is being, there's a platform that we've been developing for 50 years, and now we leverage that. We keep pushing the performance in terms of process technologies and circuits. And, one of the kind of the cornerstones of this company, aside from innovation being critical, diversity of business is important to ADI. So we're always looking for as many applications and customers as we can find for our technologies.
Got it. So let's move to another application, automotive.
Yeah.
Now, I think automotive as a percent of your total revenue has probably doubled over the last 3, 4, 5 years, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You're in the ballpark of 20% now.
Yeah, 17%, right? I think, in the last quarter,
I've been a big fan of automotive for a long time. I'm a firm believer in the content story. But can you give us your views of content increase in general in automotive, and where you see ADI's opportunity to jump on the back of that content increase? Where do you see that able to go? And I guess long term, like if autos are going to grow, auto TAM grows 3% a year, give or take, like where do you see ADI's potential and what drives that in automotive over the next few years?
Yeah, so let me start with your last question first in terms of growth pattern. My sense, we last year at our analyst day, we put out a target of growing the company sustainably at 2 to 3 times global GDP, which, depending on what you measure, is probably 6, 9%, something like that, 5, 8%. I think over the long term for ADI, we believe we can grow at the higher end of that expectation. So it's a big business for the company now. It's about $500 million plus, so the denominator is getting bigger and bigger. But I think if we can sustainably grow, and based on the pipeline that we have and the breadth of technology that we have, my sense is that that's possible. I think the reasons at a macro level are that car companies, to a large extent, are automating and electrifying, and they have to use semiconductor technology as the means to create those modalities. We have publicly talked about a relationship we've got with Audi, so I can talk a little bit about that. But they're using on average now between 6,000 and 8,000 semiconductors per car, and the number of sensor types they're going to use will increase exponentially in the years ahead. So every time there's a sensor, there's an opportunity for ADI, because our business is about interfacing with the real world and bringing very high-quality data streams and information about motion, light, sound, and all those different physical modalities into the world of digital. So, again, we're true to our thesis. We play on the high end, and we look for the toughest challenges with the car companies and the tier ones in areas like powertrain, infotainment, and safety systems. So I think it's, the car will continue, as I said, there'll be more and more sensors adopted, and there'll be communication systems adopted. So all these adoptions create opportunity for ADI.
I find something interesting about that number you just gave, 6,000, 8,000 sort of individual semiconductor components. So what does that mean for the price points? I've always thought about average semi-content per car in terms of a few hundred dollars, which would put an ASP there like 10 cents. Is that, am I underthinking the amount of content that is in?
Well let me say this. We're not selling 10-cent things in the cars.
That's why
I think there's a spectrum, Stacey. Uh-huh. I mean, there are probably things less than 10 cents in the car. There's a spectrum. But we're very much playing on the high end where performance makes a difference and where we can get well paid for the technology we're developing.
So what would you say your average content in a car is and your average, I don't know if it makes sense to talk about an average ASP.
Yeah, it's very, very hard to tell. I mean, if you're looking at a high-end car, you know, a high-end German car, it could be $100 plus in a,
Of your own content.
Of our own content. Okay. In a more modest car, low-end car, it might be a couple of dollars of safety.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends very much.
Got it. Which electronic subsystems in automobiles do you see as providing the most growth opportunities for ADI? Where are you putting your incremental investment dollars in automotive these days?
I think safety is critically important. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wants more and more safety. Governments are mandating safety more and more. And, you know, we have a play there that goes across the passive safety, mm-hmm. active safety, and predictive safety. Predictive safety based on radar, mm-hmm. Active based on gyro technologies particularly, and passive safety based around inertial sensors. So we see that as an area where we can continue to push the performance envelope. Powertrain, you know, that's an area where more and more sensors are being used to make the powertrain more efficient, to electrify things that are today electromechanical or mechanical, make them electrical. And we're developing some brand new technologies like torque sensing, for example, that will continue to allow ADI to enable some of these things to happen in the car. Mm-hmm.
How much of your automotive business today would you say sensors versus more traditional semiconductors?
It's probably in the region of 40% sensor.
Oh, really?
Something like that. Yeah.
Would you say that split is similar in your industrial business as well?
There's less sensors in the industrial business. It tends to be more classical active circuit technology.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I want to segue into industrial, actually, and I have short-term and long-term. I do want to get the short-term question out of the way. Ordinarily, I don't like to use this forum for that, but it is on people's minds. I think broadly in the industry right now, we've been seeing, I call it pockets of weakness in markets that seem to be understood, PCs, wireless comm. You're seeing it up. Obviously, you don't really have any PC exposure anymore.
Right.
Wireless comm,
right.
Sure. I mean, certainly semiconductor investors who have seen this movie play out before, in many cases, you can see pockets of weakness, one or two. Tomorrow you could have one or two more, right? So far, I think from you and from many of your peers, the core industrial, even automotive markets seem okay. They don't seem fantastic. They don't seem bad. Kind of steady Eddie at this point. Can you just talk a little bit about what you're seeing right now in terms of, customer comments, order patterns, anything that seems out of the ordinary? How can investors get any sort of degree of confidence right now that things actually are stable and can remain stable?
Yeah, well, look, there's...
And that's the last short-term question.
That's quite okay. You've got a captive audience here. I think what we see and what customers tell us is that inventories, there's a good match, I think, between supply and demand across the entire chain of industrial today. Our distributors tell us the same thing. So I think what you're seeing is a good pattern of steady growth. As you said, it's not, I think you said earlier on, it's probably a little boring.
Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong. It's a beautiful business. Thank industrial for its economics. But, we've seen as well, I think, a steady incremental increase in orders in that space since kind of February of this year. Mm. Every month we've seen a slight increase. Mm-hmm. So I think it's steady as she goes. Our customers are busy innovating, we continue to go from strength to strength, particularly with bigger customers in the industrial area. We're developing a lot of new things around the IoT, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's our core business. Mm-hmm. It's 40% plus of ADI, tens of thousands of customers, probably 18,000 product SKUs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will continue to be stable for many, many years to come. Mm-hmm. This whole IoT or this whole intelligent sensing of machines mm-hmm. and you know, prediction and so on. That is an area where I think we have an opportunity to change the growth profile in the industrial area.
So let's talk about IoT.
Yeah.
I guess first question I ask is, how does ADI actually define IoT? Because it's one of these things right now, it can almost mean anything you want it to mean. How does ADI define it?
Well, I hate the moniker. I mean, in many ways, what is it? It is something that's actually been evolving that a marketing person got a hold of and gave it a name. But it's evolving around ubiquitous sensing. Everything that can be sensed will be sensed. It's about drawing great information out of machines that help you predict health, produce maybe new service businesses around the health of machines and aircraft and in robotics, plants, and so on and so forth. But it requires sensing. It requires conversion. It requires computing, interpreting, and connection. Mm-hmm. That's really what it is. And we're seeing it now. When I talk with a lot of industrial customers, the executives, they ask me about what we can do to help them really get a grip to make their machines smarter, more intelligent, more connected. But that is essentially is what it is. I mean, and that's been emerging. It didn't just happen in the last year or two. You know, I read somewhere that, you know, everybody asks, why now? Why is it happening now? I think the best description I heard is an analogy with the world of biology. The pre-Cambrian explosion was about lots of little pieces developing, little unicell organisms. And when enough of them were available and kind of cohabitating, new life forms could develop. So I think what you're seeing in the world of semiconductors now is a lot of computing power is available cheaply, connectivity, sensing's more pervasive, we can sense more things, we can do it more accurately. And again, we're going to pick off the higher end of that, of that spectrum. And in fact, we've been organizing our own marketing and engineering activities inside the company to help us build the platforms that we need to be a player in that business.
So is the value in that business to customers derived from the ability to do the sensing and the computing and the data collection, or does the value derive from the use case and the business model and the application and and the analysis? What I've always struggled with is, can the semiconductor companies actually derive excess value from this market without actually having a hand in developing the applications and the analytics and the business models? And I've wondered, like, say what you will about Intel, most of you know I haven't been a huge fan, but in IoT, I think their view is that it drives like server sales and analytics, and I'm not convinced that that is the wrong way to look at it. So what's your view on...
Well, if I had the same vantage point of Intel, I'd probably say the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm looking at it very much from the real world in, where you need a lot of knowledge about the application. And one of ADI's great strengths over the years is that we play in many, many hundreds of unique applications where we develop a lot of knowledge about how those applications work and how to sense and to capture high-quality representations in digital form about those worlds, right, those applications. So I see it differently. I think in the areas that we will play, in healthcare, industrial, for example, where our silicon technology makes a big performance difference, we'll get well paid for that. We've also been developing algorithmic technology that we will get paid for.
Meaning around the analytics itself?
Around the analytics, around interpreting the signals and producing high-quality information that we can move around around the cloud or the computing system. So I think you'll see some new opportunities to develop some new forms of new streams of revenue in this space. And we're seeing some evidence of that now.
Do semiconductor companies need to get better at monetizing software in order to really capitalize on that?
Yes, they do. I mean, all of us are putting more and more software in. And, you know,
can you get paid? Semiconductor companies historically have not been good at getting paid.
Some of them have. I mean, there are some out there who have. You know, the Q company on the West Coast is one good example of that. But I think we're learning how to do that because, you know, fundamentally we're being asked to do more and more by our customers. In fact, what I've seen, the big shift I've seen in the customer behavior over the last 5 or 10 years is that more and more of our interactions with our customers are now with systems engineers and software engineers. The hardware engineering is now being, to a large extent, outsourced to companies like ADI. with a specific domain competence and with the scale to be able to solve meaningful size problems for our customers. So I think that gives us an opportunity to not only produce hardware in the future, but to produce for ADI to be able to produce the solutions that have a mixture of hardware and potentially algorithms over the longer term.
How many, I guess, engineers working on algorithms and software do you have versus hardware design engineers today?
It's very hard to quantify because, you know, we had this technical conference recently in Boston where we bring a couple of thousand of our engineers in every year as a it's a learning and teaching experience for people, cross-pollination of ideas. And in our demo room there, you know, what you see is more and more and more graphical user interface technology, more algorithmic technology, more software in general, combined with the hardware. But it's now an appreciable amount of the R&D spend, although the lion's share of what we spend is still in development process technology, circuit technologies, and products. But it's, you know, it's an appreciable number and growing as a portion of the R&D.
Do you see the algorithmic piece of this actually becoming bigger potentially than the semiconductor piece? Or do they have to go do they go together?
I think they go together. I mean, there's an awful lot. To be able to do good algorithms, you need a tremendous amount of knowledge of the application and the whole signal processing chain. Very hard to say. Well, I mean, I think if that does happen, it'll be a long, long, long way off. I still think the way we monetize the value of this company is through hardware, selling hardware. But the other parts of it will become a bigger piece over time.
So how long does this take? Like, over what time period do you see this driving growth? And is there any way so that you can help us quantify, I guess, degree of content increase from IoT, however you want to define it?
I think in the markets we're playing, we'll probably start seeing, you know, signs of life in terms of real revenue. We do, by the way, today sell a lot of solutions into vital signs monitoring for, you know, for different applications. Though our end game there is clinical grade vital signs monitoring. So that's an example of where today we're already selling IoT related technology. Well, I think to see an appreciable growth in areas like industrial, it'll probably take another 3-5 years before we see anything of any of any significance.
Got it. But you're engaged with the customers now to develop the solutions.
We are. And also, by the way, you need an ecosystem of partners as well to be able to play, to connect your technologies to the cloud, for example. So we're building out that whole ecosystem.
Got it. And who's running that or who's managing that at ADI in terms of forming those partnerships?
We have a VP level. One of our vice presidents is tasked with building out that technology across the company, leveraging the platforms and building the technology. So it's at a high level in the company.
Okay. I want to talk about one more end market, and that's healthcare. And this is one I think that's also grown materially. It hasn't gotten big enough yet for you to necessarily break out of industrial, but it sounded like on the last call it was starting to get reasonably close potentially to where you might start to do it. 10%-ish would be the threshold?
Yeah, you know, we're in a good position. We have a lot of new technologies that are going into, as I said, vital signs monitoring, things like monitoring of diabetes, you know, human vital signs, blood pressure, SpO2, and so on. You know, I mentioned earlier that we've also got a good position in things like imaging systems for CAT scanning and so on, digital X-ray. So I think over the next number of years, you'll see a steady growth path. Probably, you know, the higher end of our growth guidance, and you know, 10% of the company's revenue is the path we're on now.
Got it. I guess is the issue on the ramp? Is it more like the time frame and the regulatory issues, or is it a matter of like finding and growing the applications themselves?
It's as much, Stacey. I think it's as much about adoption as it is anything to do with government regulation. It just takes longer to bring the technologies into a conservative industry and get them applied, you know, in any appreciable level of volume.
Got it. I want to switch to a broader topic now, which is, I think, is probably top of mind for a lot of investors here, M&A. Obviously, the industry itself has been in a, you know, wave of consolidation. In my own opinion, it seems to be today a lot more around sort of scale and cost synergies versus maybe what we saw in the past. You've talked about within your long-term growth model, inorganic growth being a portion of that. You have a good amount of cash that's sort of sitting there. It's offshore mostly right now, but it's available dry powder for opportunities you bought. Hittite, obviously. What are your views, I guess, on M&A in the industry today in general versus what we used to see, and your views on M&A as it applies to ADA, is it to ADI specifically?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's a frenetic pace out there at the present time. With regard to
it's been
M&A.
It's a busy morning.
It's been a busy morning. It's been an interesting announcement. But I think most of the activity has been about consolidate and get the operating synergies as quickly as possible. I think the other side of that M&A equation is you buy something of strategic value that brings long-term capability and returns for you. We're in that latter camp. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hittite was clearly buy a very strong capability that allows us to bring more competence to our customers in the world of the RF and microwave domain. It was a well-run company with a very, very good balance sheet, very good P&L. We're looking, we are going to be on the acquisition side. We are going to be an acquirer, as we've shown with the Hittite deal. But our standards are high. We're interested in quality and things that bring long-term strategic value to ADI. Obviously, operating synergies, have a part to play as well. But our primary focus is build capability that we can sustain over the long term in the space that we really care about.
Do you think large transformational M&A in analog is possible?
Of course it is. I think what you've seen this morning shows that everything's possible.
I'm possible in the sense it can actually work and drive long-term value. I've always wondered, obviously analog's been very fragmented, and it feels like it's been ripe for consolidation. It hasn't happened to that degree. I've always thought about in terms of the nature of analog design itself, and it's maybe difficult to throw two disparate R&D organizations together and actually drive real value out of that. So, I mean, given your much broader knowledge of the industry and the complexities of the industry than mine, what's your view on sort of chances of success potentially for like large-scale transformative acquisitions in analog specifically?
Well, our experience with Hittite, where our instincts were very, very good about the space they were playing in, that's been a very, very quick melding of the capabilities because we were largely complementary. You put one and one together, you get something greater than the sum of the parts. Mm-hmm. I think where you do that, you've got a very, very strong chance of success. Mm-hmm. Where I mentioned earlier, there's a vacuum developing at the customer level. Mm-hmm. The more scale you can bring to solving bigger problems, the more valuable you become. So I think it's very, very doable. Right. I think it boils down to a large extent about the success of integration really boils into how well the cultures can be. Are they compatible? The engineering philosophy is similar. And I think if those things, if you can check the boxes on those things, everything's possible.
Right, and the cultural fit with Hittite seems to be extremely high.
It's very, very good. When you look at our people visiting customers, you cannot tell who was on the ADI side or the Hittite side anymore. Mm-hmm. I think the engineering meld was very strong. The geographic proximity helped as well. Very similar perspective on, both the Hittite and the ADI side about what makes good business long term.
So Hittite, you've been, I think when you were here even last year, you were talking about ADI making a much bigger push in RF, right?
Yeah.
So Hittite, from that standpoint, makes a ton of sense, I think. Turns out to be a market that's hard to grow organically.
Right.
Are there any other areas right now where you've been pushing organically where an inorganic option might be a better way to go?
Sensors, for example. There are many, many places you can play in sensors. We've upped the R&D in many of our sensor applications. But in terms of process development, product development, I think that's an area where as the IoT emerges and the need to integrate more of the sensor and the signal processing and the algorithms together, that's possibly an area of interest.
Got it. Any point of view on valuations in the space today when you're evaluating targets? Is it harder to get to a return that that you would like to see?
Well, I think we're in a pretty much zero cost of debt kind of atmosphere at the present time, so virtually everything can look accretive. Mm-hmm. The industry's had a good run over the last while, so that can work for you, right? Mm-hmm. So your own valuation can work for you, and debt is relatively cheap. Mm-hmm. So as I said, what I'm interested in is really long-term value contribution through growth and profitability.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Do you think, ADI hasn't been averse to carrying some debt, but you're not enormously levered. Do you think you'd be open to being a little more aggressive with the balance sheet at this point, whether for acquisitions or cash return or what have you?
Everything's possible. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking at many, many different options in terms of how to use the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. Over the last few years, we've been using debt as a way to just load up the, make sure we have enough cash to pay the dividends, right?
Sure.
Based on how the geographic mix of business is. So we're looking at all kinds of options, mm-hmm, in terms of, how to leverage the balance sheet more aggressively.
Got it. That's probably a good segue into the balance sheet and the operating model. So right now you're operating, you've given these long-term targets at your analyst day. And I think it was, $4 to $5 in earnings by 2020 was the number. Although I talked to some clients, I think you may be there considerably sooner.
I hope you're right.
We'll see. On the margins, though, again, I mentioned in my opening comments, you've done a phenomenal job on the margin expansion. And, I think ADI used to be in the mid to upper 50s, and now we're, 10 points plus higher than that. You're sort of in the model range now. I think you've talked about maybe being able to be closer to the high end over time, but could you talk about what further initiatives that there might be today to improve gross margins? I can imagine things like going after pricing leakage and rationalizing that sort of thing. Or are there structural levers so that you can pull or are pulling? Or at this point, is it just around revenue leverage? Or what takes the margin time?
Yeah, so I think we've got a much better mix of businesses now, mm-hmm, than we did in the past, right? So the margin, the fundamental margin dynamic is different. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of getting to the higher end of the gross margin target, which is 68%, a lot of that will come through utilization improvement. So, for example, mm-hmm, last quarter utilization was in the mid-70s. If we can get into the mid-80s, we get another 100 basis points of improvement, mm-hmm, and there's a tremendous fall through from that. We also get some accretion from the integration of Hittite. We're moving manufacturing operations offshore.
Okay. So is that not all in the model yet at this point?
It is not all in the model yet. That is still to come. That activity hasn't happened yet. It's in process.
Okay.
And I think the rest is just being smart about capturing value and holding on to it through more disciplined pricing practices. And we're getting better and better at that.
Yeah, I think that's been. I remember Jerry used to talk about some of the things you were doing with
pricing.
So this is sort of an ongoing. Has it shown? I mean, he was talking about that. I mean, it was years ago. Has it actually shown improvement since then?
Well, we're actually seeing ASP improvements, mm-hmm, across the business. So part of that is
due to mix or due to the action?
Part of it's mix and part of it's action.
Okay.
We monitor very carefully, mm-hmm, and we can look across all our businesses, uh-huh, at a market level, at a product level, and we have a great understanding of what's mix related, mm-hmm, what's, what is ASP related, mm-hmm, in terms of action. So we're getting better and better at that.
How does ADI approach pricing, by the way? I mean, the way that many semiconductors do this to their detriment, frankly, is cost plus. Much better way, typically, although it's a harder conversation to have sometimes, is through value pricing and being able to demonstrate to the client, to the customer, exactly what you're. Are you already there? Is that where you're moving toward?
We used to do the former.
Uh-huh.
You take the cost of the product and you multiply it. I think that was very much a facet of the industry, but no, it's much smarter now. We've 5 or 6 years ago, we went to a more market-oriented structure in the company.
Mm-hmm.
The analytics we have are very, very good around pricing across across all our businesses across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about now understanding better and better the value of the products, mm-hmm, that we're developing. And as I said, we're improving ASPs partly through mix and product configuration, and mm-hmm, partly through just better discipline.
Do you think you have enough manufacturing capacity in place now to meet your growth goals?
Well, we use manufacturing. We have an internal component and an external component.
It's been about half and half from my understanding.
On the foundry side, about half and half. The back end is primarily, in terms of manufacturing, the packaging is pretty much outsourced. But it's about half and half. And I think the way to think about it, Stacey, is if the need for internal, you know, if utilization gets into the kind of the mid-high 80s, then we're looking at adding more capacity inside the company. And we can do that with tremendous efficiency. You know, just last year, a couple of years ago, we increased, we have two foundries inside the company, we increased the output capability by over 20% for a $15 million investment. So it's very much a capex-light business, and there's a lot of scale we can bring to manufacturing with small incremental improvements. So, you know, our long-term model, and it has been and will continue to be that, the manufacturing side, you know, we expect to spend about 3% of revenue in capex, primarily to keep the manufacturing systems fresh and at the right level of utilization.
Got it. What revenue levels do you think you'd be at if your utilization was, you know, upper 80s? Maybe that's not a fair question to ask, but I'll ask it anyway.
I don't know, but higher than where it is.
Okay. I want to talk about OPEX. So how should investors think about operating leverage and OPEX growth? Like with incremental revenue, how much should we think about fall through? Is this a, you know, OPEX, is it growing at half the rate of revenue? Like, how do you think about, particularly if, as some investors believe, they think there could be quite a bit of, obviously, near-term revenue upside that may or may not be in the numbers yet?
Well, I think what we expect in terms of gross margin is kind of 80% plus fall through. I think on the OPEX side, you know, we've been very, very clear, and we're managing the company to not spending OPEX at more than half the rate of sales growth, right? Increasing OPEX at half the rate of sales growth. And, you know, there we're able to get 50% fall through. So I think that's the way to think about the, that model, and that's what we're running the company to and what we will continue to run the company to.
Okay. How do I ask this question? So we had a, again, you had a sort of 2020 kind of horizon for this sort of $4 to $5 EPS number. I think if I back through the math, that implied, at the midpoint, implied something like 10% annual growth through both, I guess it was presumably through both organic and inorganic methods. I want to put some of the short-term stuff aside at this point. But in general, like when you gave that long-term model, was that kind of the right level of revenue? I think you were saying kind of 2 to 3x GDP.
Yeah.
Seems like in that
ballpark. I think that's in the ballpark,
Got it.
So we said, you know, the 5 would equate to hitting the higher end of that long-term growth target, and 4 was probably in the lower end of that growth target.
Got it. And I guess on that, question went out of my head. I'll ask it again when it comes back. It's fine. I want to ask you a question about, again, I think back to OPEX, but how you think about prioritizing investments in products. So there's always this perennial, you know, viewed as a controversy on the playoff between revenue growth and margins. And I had a conversation, again, this was with Jerry before he passed away. We were at an investor who was hosting a lunch, and somebody asked him that question, like, well, how do you think about trading one off? You know, would you ever reject business that doesn't meet your targets? And he kind of looked at him, and he said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Then if you know Jerry, and he said, like, when you get business, you always take it, always, because you've already made the investment, right?
Right.
So the question is, like, we want to ask yourself, what kind of business do we want to be in? And that's a question we ask ourselves every day. So I guess in that framework, I'm assuming that has not changed.
No,
how do you think about prioritizing investments?
I think the way to think about it is very much the markets you play and the way you play in the markets will determine ultimately what you can get from, you know, in terms of margin throughput. And the markets we're playing in, some of them, you know, have margins way above the corporate average and some, you know, a little below the corporate average. But I think what we're very heavily focused on is, you know, we're playing in those markets, we're playing at the high end of technology, focus on getting earnings fall through, focus on getting earnings leverage. So I think that's the way to think about it. So when it comes to, you know, do I focus on, you know, all things being equal, do I focus on growth, do I focus on gross margin? Focus on growth. Growth solves a lot of problems. So that's the way to think about it.
Okay. And I guess given maybe some of the changes in mix that may be happening over the next couple of quarters, possibly, you don't see any significant changes in the like the way the company's running now in terms of operating model?
Correct.
Okay.
That's right.
Got it. I guess on that one, I want to ask you a cycle question. And I mean, the question is basically, is there anything as such a thing as a cycle anymore? This has been sort of an odd one. I mean, I guess they're all different.
Yeah.
You've seen more than your...
Yeah.
More than your share.
Yeah, 30 years plus, I've seen quite a few.
Yeah, what do you think about what we're seeing in the industry now sort of broadly? In I could make the claim or build the case that given some of the drivers out there around industry consolidation and, you know, concentration of leading edge spend and better channel management, for example. I know you're doing some interesting things on the channel side.
Yeah.
Like, is there a reason to believe that cyclicality should be less? And, like, how is ADI sort of managing to that?
I think there was a cycle in our business probably prior to 2004 or 5. Mm-hmm. There were kind of 2 years on, a year off. That was kind of the cycle. I don't see that anymore. I see a much better correlation between GDP growth and what's happening in the semi sector, aside from portable. Take portable out. There's a much better match between GDP and semis.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a number of reasons. At the present time, I talked earlier on about a good match between supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
I think the transparency that we all have now, you know, we can measure what is happening at every customer, every product, whatever the region.
Mm-hmm.
The transparency we've got in terms of being able to look at true demand, I think, is much, much greater than it used to be.
How do you look at that? Because I get the idea that, you know, you do sell-through distribution. So
yeah.
You get that, but I mean, you still have, I mean, it's hundreds of end markets and thousands of products and tens of thousands of customers. How do you get actually a read of what's going on at every individual
company? We have an extraordinary capability.
Uh-huh.
We can literally see every customer, irrespective of channel or geography, what is going on with every customer in terms of point of sale, order rates, and so on. I think the other thing that's happened is that, so transparency, I think, is better across the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Consolidation, of course, has taken out inventory points along the way as well. And I think our customers have become better at managing supply and demand. So a lot of it is just better supply chain management and overall, you know, inventory is able to move faster. We can move, information moves faster. We're able to move products faster. So I think all that has helped create a better supply demand balance.
Got it. We've got about a little over 10 minutes left. I want to talk about, again, I want to leave some time at the end for question cards if there are any. I do want to talk a bit about use of cash.
Yeah.
And so I think you have a target right now to return, I think it's
80%.
And you've been doing a little bit better than that this year. Share count's still been going up, though. Maybe recently it's kind of level up. I mean, how should investors think about use of cash in terms of dividend, buyback, acquisitions? How should investors think about the likely trajectory of share count going forward, and then, like, are you able to support those views still with the onshore cash generation that you have versus the offshore?
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, Stacey, if we need to take on some debt to make sure we can support our commitments, we'll do that. But I think our primary focus in terms of cash distribution is on the you know, the dividend. We have a formulaic approach to share buybacks. You know, we use a formula for buybacks within certain time windows, and at least for the foreseeable future, the focus will be on dividend, and you know, just letting the formula take care of the share buyback.
So, is that a statement on the current valuation of the stock?
No, it's just the formula that we use. It's always very hard to figure out when to buy, when to, you know. So, you know, we've let the formula run for several years now.
What drives the formula?
it's time based and it's time based and average share price based.
Okay. How do you think about a variable compensation and bonus structure? I know I don't know how it's done now. It used to be based on year-over-year revenue growth and operating margin targets.
Right.
And again, that growth seems to be picking up, and those operating margins seem to be getting pretty close to the high end of those targets. I think you talked a bit before about maybe making some changes to those models. I don't know if you ever actually have, but how should we be thinking about that and the implications of maybe the new trajectories that we're seeing now on variable comp and OPEX growth?
Well, we have shifted over the last couple of years. We have shifted the targets. We've upped the operating profit target, and we've also upped the long-term growth target.
Mm-hmm.
So most people who are on the bonus program get paid. It's basically half on operating profit, half on revenue growth.
Still.
Okay. Still. The sales force, of course, is based, their incremental gain is on the basis of revenue growth. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good, I think that's a very good formula for running the company. Mm-hmm. It makes it clear to people that revenue growth is important, mm-hmm. Growth and profit's important. And, you know, for the sales force, you know, you've got to turn the product, you know, turn the product portfolio into cash.
Got it. And so does that basically correspond to the objective function that you're optimizing the company on, basically revenue growth and profit?
I think it does.
Yeah.
I think it does. Okay. Growth, you know, at the end of the day, as I said earlier, growth solves an awful lot of problems.
Yeah.
And in the businesses we're playing, the you know, if we're smart about the technologies we're bringing, the way we're managing pricing, the margins happen. Very, very good efficiency.
Got it. What's ADI doing in China today that may be different from what you might have been doing, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
Well, I think 10 years ago, you know, we as a company got really serious about building a direct infrastructure in the region, both in terms of sales and applications, but also, you know, over the last 5 or 7 years, we've been building out design teams in the region, product development teams, to help us define products for our customers there in a more accurate way, and also to develop products for customers not only in China but elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the infrastructure that we've got there now to do business in the region is much greater than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a tremendous maturation in China as well over the last few years, in the sense that Chinese customers now talk a lot more about innovation
mm-hmm.
than they talk about volume and cost. So I think there's a big opportunity there.
Is there risk there as well? What's your sort of take on the potential of Chinese homegrown competition in analog?
Analog is a, look, of course, I think you will see particularly startup companies try to, you know, but when you think about what it is we have, it's very hard to replicate. We've got more than 20,000 product SKUs.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a lot of craft. We have a lot of applications know-how,
mm-hmm.
a lot of process technologies that are very, very proprietary. So, you know, I think what we've got to do is just keep innovating at a very, very high rate, and the rest takes care of itself. The competitive side of ADI will be ready for everything.
I guess a broader question on that, where do you see, like, the most potential competition? Like, what do customers say to you when you win a socket or when you lose a socket? Like, where does the biggest sort of competitive challenge come from that you're, you know, that you work on?
Probably, consumer. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, consumer has just more opportunity. You know, it's on a higher clock speed. There's more opportunity for competition as you move from generation to generation. And probably the other end of the spectrum, you'd say industrial, much less so.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other somewhere in the middle.
It's always a trite question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What keeps you up at night when you think about running this company?
Imagining what could be.
Uh-huh.
We've tremendous opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I think for us it's more about how do we continue to build the capabilities inside this company to capture mm-hmm. bigger and bigger swaths of opportunity. I spend more of my time thinking about that than anything else,
mm-hmm.
about developing this company for the future.
Mm-hmm. Got it. We have about 5 minutes left. I'm going to put one more call up for question cards if anybody has any. We'll go to the lightning round. Got it. What aspect of the IoT infrastructure or ecosystem, data analytics, communication infrastructure, sensors, et cetera, has a business risk of underwhelming development? I don't know what that means, actually, underwhelming development. Oh, I see.
Yeah, well, we know, for example, that the opportunities there for in the businesses that are more traditional to ADI, like industrial automation, for example, robotics, plant automation, process automation, we're working with some of the biggest OEMs in that area across the sensor space. Sometimes we'll build the sensors, sometimes we'll partner with them and partner our signal processing technology. I think the question in areas like industrial is, how fast does it happen? It's not a question of if IoT happens in industrial automation. It's when it happens. You know, you've seen already, you know, TV advertisements from some of the bigger OEMs out there around how they're instrumenting aircraft engines and taking data from aircraft engines and building finance and service models around that. That enables them to build a whole new business model. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really more of that. In terms of 4G and 5G, look, the penetration of 4G into the world, I mean, today in, you know, this city, you try to get a good connection and you want to bring any form of wideband data to your mobile device, it's dysfunctional. So there's a long, long way to go. I think the penetration rates of 4G are still sub 10% across the globe. So this has got a long, long way to go. And it's fundamentally a lumpy business. Some quarters will be better than others, but over the long term, it's a must-have. You've got to have good quality movement of data and information in a modern economy, mm-hmm. and it's got to be mobile.
Got it. There's a question here on capital allocation that I think you've mostly answered, but the more specific question here is there a certain level of leverage that you might be comfortable with? You've talked about you're willing to take on debt, but is there a certain level?
Yeah, well, look, we're obviously interested in keeping our credit rating. So that gives you one portal, right, to view leverage. So that might be the most obvious one.
Mm-hmm. Got it. We have about 3 minutes, 3 minutes left. I'm going to give you your soapbox now. Got a room full of investors. Some may be familiar with the story, some may not be. Hopefully they're a little more familiar now. But why should investors buy ADI stock?
How many know the ADI story? Okay, quite a few. Yeah, so look, we've just celebrated our 50th anniversary as a company. And, you know, in an industry where the success rate of technology companies, by the way, is less than 1 in 1,000 over a 50-year period, we've done well. And I think the best years are still ahead of us. The technologies that we have sitting at the intersection of the physical world and the digital world, those technologies are coming into play more and more. And, you know, I pay a lot of attention to what happens outside with our customers and our competition partners and so on. Our customers are asking us to solve ever more sophisticated and complex problems. So I think we're in a great space. There's a lot of demand for the technologies that we have. And, you know, we will continue as a company to build more and more capability to allow our footprint to increase within these applications in which we're playing. And, you know, we talked at the Investor Day last year. We talked about we believe now that we're in the third wave of information and communication technology. The first one was about big iron, mainframe computing, mm-hmm. building fundamental capabilities and semiconductor capabilities. The second wave was about mobility and personal computing. The third wave is about massive deployment of sensor technologies to make machines more and more smart, mm-hmm. to make them more automated, and to make them more useful to us in healthcare, industrial, automotive, and so on and so forth. So I think many of the things we have are instrumental to being able to realize this Internet of Things, this third wave of information communication technology. So I'm very bullish. I'm more bullish now than I was 10 years ago, and I believe our best years are ahead of us.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stacey.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.